center. Allow the horse time to look the equipment over. Move between the equipment and the horse several times in both directions until your subject prefers to follow you instead of examining the tack. Once you have his attention, snap one line to the halter, placing the line over your left arm about 3 feet from the snap. Gently place the saddle pad on his back, first ahead of the withers and then sliding it back in place. If he walks away, don't punish him. Just ease him around, cause him to join up, and repeat the process, though you shouldn't have to. Once the pad's in place, pick up the saddle, with the irons up and the girth over the seat. Slide your body along the near side of the neck to the point of the shoulder. With the saddle resting on your right hip, gently place the saddle on his back and move past his head, giving him a rub on the offside. Without hesitation, take the girth down slowly and smoothly. Adjust the girth to reach approximately to the mid-fetlock joint and move smoothly back to the near side, giving the head a rub on the way by. Stand near the foreleg and bring the girth up and place the front buckle on the front billet. Draw it snug, reading your horse all the way. Don't make it too tight, but tight enough that it won't turn if he bucks. Next, place the back buckle on the back billet and snug it up a bit tighter than the front one. Go back to the front one and level the two up. Unsnap the line and step back cautiously, line in hand, moving backward away from your horse. Favor the rear portion, staying out of the kick zone. Send him away with the line and be careful not to encourage joining up and bucking at the same time. Above all, stay calm. Your horse must believe that he is the only one bothered by this saddle, or he'll be more inclined to buck. Watch for signs that he once again wants to join up, but only allow it when he's traveling comfortably with the saddle. As soon as he's back with you, put the bridle on and place the reins under the rear of the saddle or some other place of safe attachment. Leave plenty of slack in the reins. Now take your extra stirrup leather and drop it through the off-stirrup iron so that it hangs halfway through. Then move to the near side and carefully pick up both ends of the leather and buckle it through the near iron. The stirrups are thus buckled together under the horse. Take both lines at the snap end and place one over the seat of the saddle, allowing the snap to just reach the ground on the offside. Then place the second snap through the near iron, back to front, and snap it on the near side bit ring. Move to the offside and repeat. Move back to the near side. Pick up the two lines at the side of the horse and move backward and laterally, outside the kick zone, toward the rear of the horse. You're now justified in moving him forward and swinging the right rein over his hips to the long lines. If you're not experienced with long lines, move slowly. You want to accomplish a little communication through the mouth, but do it cautiously. Practice this process with older, more experienced horses for a significant period of time before you try it with a first-timer. You could hurt your horse or yourself. If you are experienced with lines, ask your horse to circle at the canter and then trot both ways. Ask him to negotiate turns and stops. Finally, stop him, facing away from the center, and ask him to rein back one step. At this point, most horses I start are ready to be ridden. You may elect to ride him yourself or have another person do so. Either way is fine. Make sure the saddle is adjusted properly and the girth is tight enough to prevent the saddle from turning. If you're using a rider, bring in that rider, wearing, of course, all proper safety equipment. Snap a line on the near side bit ring. Give your rider a minute or two to get acquainted with the horse. Have the rider rub both sides of the horse and treat him as you have. I then leg my rider up. First, I ask the rider to just belly over so that the rider's belt buckle lies against the pommel. Then I move the horse carefully, first in two or three left circles and then to the right two or three times. If the horse is happy in accepting the rider lying over him, guide the rider's foot into the near iron as he mounts. Repeat the circles. If your horse is relaxed in accepting the seated rider, make larger circles that lead the horse nearer the perimeter. Carefully unsnap the line and help the rider accomplish a circle of the pen in each direction. No cantering. Walk and trot will suffice. After each revolution, I like my rider to rein back one step. Don't rush matters. If your horse isn't ready to be mounted, do it another day. Remember that my demonstrations must be done in one session so that viewers can see the entire procedure. This doesn't mean that you must do the same. This system of starting horses will save so much time that even moving slowly and cautiously, you'll still be well ahead. It's the quality of your work that matters, not how fast you accomplish it. We all want the well-behaved, happy, and willing horse at the conclusion. It's on this result that you'll be judged. When the horse has accepted saddle, bridle, and rider, he should not be traumatized and should elect to stay with you rather than go away. Remember, let your animal be free. Don't restrict. Make it pleasant for him to be near you, and put him to work if he wants to be away from you. No pain. If you can accomplish this process, then you have helped to make the world a better place for the horse.
The End. You've been listening to The Man Who Listens to Horses by Monty Roberts, narrated by Ed Sala, with additional material read by Richard M. Davidson. Lawrence Scanlon writes in the afterword, "Monty Roberts is sometimes the horseman of last resort. Horses under death sentence are brought to him for one final attempt at solving their phobias. If he fails, the horse boards a trailer and is never seen again. During some time I spent with Monty early in 1997, I watched on successive evenings as he worked in the round pen with a bright-eyed brown mare named Robin. I remember how she looked right at me when I lit my pipe, how keen her interest, how alert her gaze. I had wanted this sweet and gentle thoroughbred to succeed in any case, but from that moment I wanted it a little more. Rehabilitation for this horse had been a roller coaster. Tuesday was a nightmare. Wednesday was a dream. This evening, Thursday, offered a little of both. Monty had until Sunday to undo the terrible damage that a human had done to the horse. Otherwise, she was a dangerous horse who would have to be put down. Robin's conundrum was this. She was terrified of standing tied. Perhaps someone had whacked her one time when she balked a little at a rope. Perhaps that person had continued to hit her, escalating matters until he or she had inflicted on the horse a full-blown, deep-seated phobia. When Monty tied Robin to a post on the rim of the round pen where the good doctor typically attends his equine patients, all hell broke loose. To see what transpired there was to be reminded that a horse is two animals. There's the horse amiably led on a halter rope or grazing in his paddock or snoozing in his stall. The horse we think we know. The one we instinctively want to stroke and pat on the nose and spoil with carrots. But this mare at the end of the rope was another creature entirely. Monty had led her to the post, quietly tied her there, then gingerly backed away, as if he had just lit a stick of dynamite and sought cover behind a rock. Monty was the mare's comfort, and within seconds she realized her plight and began to thrash like a marlin, diving and leaping to spit the hated hook. From my vantage on the elevated walkway around the pen, I winced every time she hit the turf, rolling like a felled tree in a storm. She tore up the ground, and when her hooves hammered the wall of the pen, I silently pleaded with her. "Please don't break a leg. Please stop. Please." Finally she lay there, grounded, chest heaving, the taut rope around her neck straining at the dead weight of her, her eyes wide and circling. As wrenching and pitiful a sight as I had ever seen. "It's like heroin," Monty said aloud to the gallery, where four of his students had gathered to watch their professor. He was staring at the mare as he spoke, his look, like his voice, at once compassionate and detached. She's addicted to pulling. In previous days at the farm, the mare had broken all manner of ropes and halters, including some guaranteed by their manufacturers. But Monty now had her attached to a device that he hoped would endure her manic pulling and awesome strength. "Pound for pound," said Monty, "this is the strongest horse I've ever seen." A thick rope circled one of the massive round wooden pillars set outside the pen to support the roof. This rope then led to a buckle, more rope, then a 3-foot length of tough inner tube. The rubber, perhaps, had enough given strength to take pressure off the rope, and the mare might thus be spared yet a little more trauma and the danger of injury that a snapped rope could bring. But now she rose, dug in with her hooves, squared herself to face the pillar, and with every fiber in her body, began to pull. She seemed to grow in stature as a fierce and mostly silent battle ensued. The inner tube lengthened ominously, the rope slowly twisted under the strain. I watched and waited for something to give. The rope, the buckle, the rubber, the horse. Robin went on pulling, seemingly oblivious to the pain that the noose-like rope must have inflicted on her neck. I hated what I saw, but couldn't look away. All eyes were on the bright-eyed mare. Monty warned away a student near the pillar, worried that if a link in the chain of rope-rubber rope snapped, the mare would be catapulted backward and the buckle might go the other way, like a missile from a lethal slingshot. But the apparatus held, and the mare eased up a little. The war of tugging had taken a toll on her. Monty approached her carefully, looking to the ground, as he always does with unfamiliar horses before patting her on the head, soothing her with his hands, talking to her, encouraging her. How sweet the calm in the tempest's wake! Monty was wary. A life with horses had taught him that, but at his age, his body battered by all he's been through, he's nowhere near as nimble as he once was. There's no doubting that to touch that mare at that moment required courage. No doubting that Monty Roberts has deep wells of it. At times, the tethered mare seemed ready to flap again, like that hooked marlin. And to stand too close to the wall within range of her was to risk being crushed or kicked. The horse had learned that pulling would liberate her, end her rope-induced agony. Now she would learn a new and hard truth. That pulling got her nowhere. Monty understood that she had to see that for herself. The heroin addict, he would say, must be allowed to hit bottom before rehabilitation can begin. The mare seemed to possess the intelligence to grasp that. But did she possess the will? Monty took her off the apparatus and moved her into the center of the ring. He used the halter rope to lead her forward, then laid the rope against her chest to urge her backward. She responded freely and willingly, never once hesitating. Good girl, Robin, good girl. Then he attached her once more to the rope and rubber, and though she seemed discomfited, she managed. The addict said no to the needle. Now a student led the mare away to another post in a big covered arena, and again she passed the test. Flying colors this time. I lit my pipe as they led her to the gate where I stood, and there they paused while Monty talked to a student. The mare seemed enchanted with my pipe and the smoke, and I wondered where the other creature, the phobic one, had gone. This mare seemed almost tiny. That other one had grown tall in her terror. Weeks later, when I returned to the farm, the mare was still there. The owner was no longer willing to spend money on her rehabilitation, but neither was he insisting that she be shot. It would take time to heal her, but Monty believed it was possible. So he'd simply taken her under his wing, as he had so many other outcasts, troubled children, wounded deer, reject horses. Determined that he succeed. Determined that she should have a good and decent life. Of course, I want that mare in her stall, not in some trailer bound for an abattoir. Monty Roberts wants that, too. But he wants a lot. A better world for horses and indeed all animals. A better world for humans. What has Monty learned about horses that might prove useful to the way that humans deal with one another? Horses, he says, have been his best teachers, but surely the round pen and the rodeo ring are one thing, the human arena quite another. Not at all, argues Monty. It's the same psychology. If Monty Roberts would recast humankind's contract with horses, he's equally passionate about rethinking our contract with each other, in our working relationships and business dealings, and especially between parents and children. Monty often calls himself a horse psychologist, but when he was a student at Cal Poly, he was drawn to human psychology, too. By the time he and Pat were themselves parents of three children, he'd had extensive experience working with street kids damaged by drugs, physical abuse, indifferent care, and a host of other social disorders. While Monty's world of horses was taking its many varied and sometimes tortured turns, the idiosyncratic Roberts household was also taking shape. Over time, Pat and Monty took in 47 children, some staying for years and living like brothers and sisters to Deborah and Laurel and Marty. By Monty's reckoning, every one of those 47 children had cause to falter. Typically 12 to 14 years of age, some had tangled with school authorities or the law, some had been dismissed as backward, some were hooked on hard drugs or suffered from eating disorders. Most came from dysfunctional families. Here were nestlings with broken wings, but again, by Monty's own reckoning, 40 of them learned to fly, many of them well. The rest landed in jail or returned to the streets and died there. Their fates were, of course, distressing blows to Monty and Pat, but he argues that given the baggage these children came with, their overall outcome reflects well on his approach. And it's his approach that Monty wants the world to consider. Monty tells the story of a boy and a horse and water, and it encapsulates the spirit of his thinking. The story is perhaps too neat, too close to parable, but I found myself dwelling on it later. At one point in their lives, Pat and Monty took in a 9-year-old child. Let's call him, for the sake of the story, Matt. The boy had an interest in horses, wanted one particular horse to ride and work with on his own. Fine, said Monty, but you must respect the horse. You will be responsible for keeping that horse brushed and fed and watered. Matt agreed. A few weeks later, Monty noticed that the horse lacked water on a hot day and was pawing at his bucket. Monty watered him. When Matt got home from school, he was upset at his forgetfulness. At this point, he and Monty entered into a written contract in which a 4-ounce water glass figured prominently. If Matt neglected to water the horse, he would have to fill the horse's bucket by degrees, using that glass and water from a faucet 50 feet from the stall until the horse was satisfied and the bucket was full. The glass would sit on a shelf in the tack room and need never be used, only serve as a useful reminder. But 3 weeks later, Matt forgot again. Glass in hand, he set about his task. Each time he returned with the tumbler and emptied it into the bucket, the parched horse would drink it in one swallow. By midnight, Matt was still at it. Pat had gone down to check on him. The stalls are some distance from the farmhouse. And she worried aloud to Monty about how exhausted he seemed. "Should I let you stop before the bucket's full?" Monty asked Matt. The boy shook his head. By the time the bucket was nearly full and the horse was clearly sated, the boy had probably moved 7 to 10 gallons of water, a glass at a time. It was 2 a.m. when Monty put his arm around Matt's shoulder. "I'm very proud of you," he said. You accepted responsibility for your actions. Together they walked up the winding road to the house. That day, says Monty, was a turning point in Matt's life. The change was remarkable. His schoolwork had been on the bottom, and he went to straight A's. His self-confidence went from a 1 to a 9. He'd been a meek, withdrawn boy who'd been urinating on the playground and labeled by his teachers as severely learning impaired. Eventually, his gift for mathematics was discovered, and before leaving grammar school, he was tackling university-level math. Matt later graduated from college and started a successful business. While living at the Roberts' farm, he never again had occasion to use the glass. If parents and their children sometimes need to renegotiate, to learn the nature of respect and self-respect, so too, says Monty, do corporations and employees. We used to have whips on ships. It used to be okay to beat a child or for a husband to beat a wife. And we still possess a strong thread of that in our corporate structure. It's wrong, and it's not effective either. Since 1990, thousands of corporate officers, educators, physicians, and others. The list to date includes more than 240 firms and organizations from around the world. Have come to Flag Is Up Farms to hear what a man known for his horse skills has to teach about people skills. Monty's philosophy is rooted in respect and ends with expectations clearly defined. People must be allowed to fail, he says, but do not protect the lazy or incompetent. Above all, people must be allowed to succeed and be rewarded if they meet or exceed the terms of the contract. For centuries, says Monty, humans have said to horses, you do what I tell you or I'll hurt you. Humans still say that to each other, still threaten and force and intimidate. I'm convinced that my discoveries with horses also have value in the workplace, in the educational and penal systems, in the raising of children. At heart, I'm saying that no one has the right to say you must to an animal or to another human. It's a great leap, of course, from a contract written on a tack-room blackboard about watering a horse to the complex interplay between an individual employee and a multinational corporate entity. And Monty is the first to recognize that point. But just as trust has to be won with a horse, so must it be won between people and the organizations that employ them. Monty Roberts hopes that his pioneering work in the human-to-horse field has so opened up the potential for communication that decades hence the relationship will evolve and change beyond recognition. Similarly, our understanding of human-to-human interactions might also take great leaps forward. That, too, is his hope. Meanwhile, Monty Roberts goes around the world working with horses and spreading the word. Inflicting pain does not work. The occasional public demonstrations, especially those involving abused horses, have stirred deeply buried emotions in some onlookers. For any in the audience who have themselves been abused, the horse in the ring becomes an almost too potent metaphor. During one demonstration at Flag Is Up Farms, 5 women, all of them, as it turned out, victims of violence, fainted. On another occasion, Monty was doing a demonstration in England when a young girl approached him during the intermission. I knew instinctively she'd been abused, he said. I invited her back later, and then I took her and her father aside and told him we had to talk about his daughter, and that I had as much sympathy for the abuser as for the victim. The man began to weep. Subsequently, Monty helped him get counseling. But the most compelling incident took place in Dublin. Monty was working in a round pen with a so-called mad horse before a throng of people. The horse's owner, a handsome, agitated woman, had previously explained how impossible it was even to catch the horse in the paddock. My husband, she told Monty, is a good horseman, a tough horseman, and he says this horse is a maniac. In the ring, Monty used hand motions to prove to his satisfaction that the horse had been beaten. I'm going to tell you what the horse is saying, he told the audience through his lapel microphone. Maybe I'm misinterpreting. Maybe he's lying. So we'll take it with a grain of salt, but let's listen. A few minutes later, he went on. He's saying he's been kicked in the belly and head and had a whip across the hocks. This horse is full of stories. At that point, Monty looked over to the woman, who was frozen in her aspect, her mouth open. Her face betrayed her sudden doubts about the wisdom of letting this man tell all about her horse, and more. She was looking across the ring to her husband, and when I spotted him, I knew the horse was telling the truth. Horses, in fact, never lie, and this horse was no exception. The horse comes to me, I saddle him and get a rider on, and the horse is moving around like $1 million. By now, both the man and his wife are extremely distraught. Someone, Monty said into the microphone, has to apologize to this horse. The demonstration over, the crowd began to leave the arena. The woman approached Monty in the ring. You're in danger, he told her. I can't talk about that, she replied. I'd rather give up my life. When her husband joined them, Monty told them that their lives would be a shambles until they got a handle on the violence. Monty had cut to the quick, and the response was immediate and emotional. The man threw his arms around Monty and pleaded, I need help, I need help. It must have been a riveting scene. In the ring where a mad horse had been proven sane, three people, their arms entwined, linked by a common history of pain. The man did get the help he needed, and now conducts seminars for other men who use their fists on the people they say they love. And so the man who listens to horses and bids us to do the same has an added task, imploring humans to listen to each other. Late in March of 1997, Monty Roberts set out to complete a circle. Almost 50 years after first watching wild horses in the high desert, he would return to that terrain and try to get close to a fiery little Mustang. As Monty the boy had done, Monty the man packed his saddlebags with beef jerky, tied a red bandana around his neck, and set out on his quest. The Mustang Project, as I came to call it, sought to answer this imposing question. Could Monty Roberts gentle a wild horse virtually in the wild? No round pen, no light cotton line, no half-hour join-up. Just a 61-year-old man with a suspect back, riding long and hard, day and night, in pursuit of a wild animal more prone to flee than to stop for a chat. Monty Roberts had joined up with Mustangs as a boy in 1952, but because he kept that experience and even his ideas on horses to himself, we now see why. No one knew other than a few confidants such as Bill Dorrance, brother of Tom Dorrance, a notable horse gentler. Who would believe him anyway? 45 years later, the BBC decided to document the event. This film would allow Monty to say two things. I did, and I still can. All that time working in the virtual dark can give a man a craving for the light. The Mustang film was inherently somewhat contrived, as all films are, but at the end of it, Monty's message about the wisdom of gentling horses would be clearly seen. First you show the world, then you change the world. The Mustang Project started when someone at Flagger's Up Farms noticed an upcoming sale of Mustangs. The Bureau of Land Management, which oversees America's wild horses and regulates their numbers, periodically offers Mustangs for adoption, an alternative to culling their numbers by killing them. Monty drew the 52nd and final card. He had his eye on a 13.2-hand, 3-year-old bay, and when it came Monty's time, the horse was still there. The BBC immediately warmed to the Mustang Project when it was proposed to them. The British edition of The Man Who Listens to Horses had sold extremely well, and no doubt helped by the royal imprimatur, stirred interest both in Monty's life and in his ideas about horses. When I arrived at the farm on Good Friday, March 28, 1997, the six-person film crew was there. Monty and I had talked about the project weeks beforehand, and he seemed intense about the mountain of detail. Hired wranglers, RVs and scissor lifts, BBC bureaucrats. He had the air of a commodore impatient that the fleet keep up as he plowed forward with his dream. He saw this as a kind of last hurrah, or at least a last hurrah in the saddle, and he was determined that it'd go well. Monty felt confident, as ever, in his ability to get through to the horse. But he was also acutely aware that this was an extraordinary and difficult undertaking, and that if things went wrong, he would have egg on his face and the British Broadcasting Corporation to mollify. What if the Mustang got hung up on a barbed wire fence? Would Monty's surgically buttressed back endure such a ride? Would the cameras spook the wild horse? Would the weather hold? Saturday, March 29th. With its western facade, the Maverick Saloon in Santa Ynez is more like a Montana hangout than anything I ever imagined for California. The film crew is gathering sound and color. Line dancing, a choreographed human dressage that requires hours of schooling beforehand. Art Green's band, windblown cowboys, exquisitely tall cowgirls, black string ties, straight leg blue jeans, fancy red boots. The conceit of the film is to be established here, so three horsemen opine on the porch. They tip up their felt hats, shake their heads, pronounce Mountie out of his cotton pickin'. But old-time roper Dutch Wilson says that while trying to gentle a Mustang in the wild is a ludicrous proposition, Monty Roberts can do it if anyone can. That night, the tension in Monty is all gone. He is ready. At 9 p.m., he leaves the saloon and heads off alone in his truck, hauling a trailer and three horses. The cadet, Big Red Fox, and, of course, Dooley. By now, it's cold outside. The high desert of the Kiama Valley will be colder still. A woman seated beside me assures me in a friendly way that line dancing is much easier than it looks and threatens to take me out on the dance floor. Time to go. Sunday, March 30th. Wilderness bound at dawn with Pat Roberts in her van. Northeast of Solvang, the land gradually rises, then turns harsh as you leave the coast. On each trip to this wild valley, I have admired a massive fist-shaped rock formation. This way, the Standing Rock seems to point. This way to the Mustang Project. I know, thanks to John McPhee's Assembling California, that a rock mass caught between fault lines is what geologists call a horse. I cannot be sure that my fist-shaped rock is a true horse, but I like the notion that it is. Geologists, wrote McPhee, are like dermatologists crawling like fleas on the world's tough hide. The high desert's seismic skin astonishes with its range of color. Ochre, burnt orange, slate gray, myriad chalk and cream colors, the granite carved and layered and fractured. Sycamores line the dry riverbeds in the Kiama Valley, hoping for a drink that this year might not come. The white oaks are leafing out. The live oaks are evergreen. Sage, yucca, and cactus grow from dust here in the Kuyama, as they call it. I like the names. Lower China Creek, Green Canyon, Wasioha Creek, the Caliente Mountains. Up and down the valley, I notice the white boxed hives, the bees foraging on the sage and sometimes hitting the van windshield like hail. Monty has said that tarantulas occasionally darken the roads with their numbers. Higher up the valley, I see the odd oil rig, one lone hang glider riding the updrafts, and quite a few cattle in pastures that stretch all the way to the mountains. What there is not in this wide and desolate valley is people. Down a half-mile-long dust road, through two cattle gates and over one river, is Pat Russell's ranch, Shoot Headquarters. The film crew is active, the sound man gleefully checking his equipment and alternately singing and humming, "Rollin', rollin', rollin', keep them doggies rollin', keep them doggies rollin', rawhide." Perhaps he records what he now hears. Horses nickering, cattle complaining, birds beckoning, the wind rising, the hum of man and nature gearing up. A young wrangler named Scott Silvera, he will ride the Mustang, if the Mustang's agreeable, mounts his own stallion who gives him a loud 90-second imitation of a bucking bronc. "Is the film crew getting all this?" laughs Scott as he hangs on to his pink-eyed, skew-bald, and very wired horse. Pat Russell, as beefy as Monty but taller, will head up the wranglers and work behind the scenes. He knows the ropes. A lot of film crews have been out here over the years, he tells me. Countless Marlboro Man cigarette ads were shot here for television, magazines, and billboards. The creators like the big feeling, how the pine forest, the ocean, the craggy hills, and the high desert all intersect here, where the ranches are as big as 40,000 acres. Only later do I learn that Pat Russell was and is a Marlboro Man himself, and ever since the early 1970s has featured in countless ads riding the range or sitting by a fire in a chuck wagon. Truth is, I never once saw this cowboy icon light up. Like many cowboys, he doesn't smoke, but chews his tobacco. Pat warns us about the snakes now emerging from their dark winter dens. Blind, hungry, and cranky, they strike out at body heat. The film crew is disconcerted to hear about the 56-inch rattler killed on Pat's ranch the week before. For the next 4 days, those without cowboy boots think snake with every step. Monty, chaps over his blue jeans and wearing his usual straw hat and brown oilskin jacket, tacks up the cadet. Nearby, on a sorrel quarter-horse mare named Sharon, is Caleb Twistleman. A fresh-faced 16-year-old from nearby Carissa Plains, he will help Monty physically accomplish his task, and he listens as Monty explains to him, and thus to the film audience, what he's doing and why. Caleb's presence drives home the point that Monty is going back to his youth. But the circle resonates another way. Caleb's mother, Kathy, a wrangler on the set, learned how to ride in San Luis Obispo decades beforehand. Her teacher, Pat Roberts. Monty tells me that sleeping in the truck the night before brought back memories of cold nights in the Nevada desert. That morning, he rose into the saddle at 7:30 to help the wranglers. Pat Russell, Kathy and Caleb Twistleman, Barney Skelton, and Scott Silvera evict cattle from a flatland chosen for this portion of the filming. The wild horse had been corralled at Pat Russell's ranch for a month, with one horse to keep him company, a corral mate, before being released into a herd of semi-feral horses. The film would now record the drama of the two horses, still together for company, being cut out of that herd. Monty would then begin the long process of join-up with the wild Mustang. Here in the high meadow, the wind through the oaks is a constant, like rapids. Riffling through the long grass, the wind makes mesmerizing patterns, turns knolls kinetic. California's never what it seems. The distant mountains can look baked brown, the meadows a monotonous green. But get low to the ground, checking first for snakes, of course, and the modest but prolific wildflowers begin to impress. Pat's wife Claudia says that people come from all over the country to see the 185 varieties. Purple lupines, Johnny jump-ups, Indian hyacinths, fiddlenecks shaped like violas, owl's clover with their little yellow eyes, strawberry clover, hog's fennel, gold-colored California poppies. Suddenly, the director's walkie-talkie comes alive. The herd is coming. It is, as I imagined it would be, a magnificent sight. 25 horses galloping across the plain. Horses on the run are still an emblem of freedom, still and maybe more than ever, exhilarating to see. The herd settles around a solitary oak on an otherwise treeless flat. Scouted thoroughly, this place has been carefully chosen. The riverbed on one side, steep hills on another, and a barbed wire fence line behind. The place offers the wranglers a space to maneuver, yet one with borders. At first, I have trouble picking out the Mustang with my binoculars. But soon, more than his small size and one white hind sock distinguish him. It's his guardedness. The other horses, some of them rodeo broncs, have all had some human contact. While the wranglers encircle the herd, the horses graze. The Mustang, though, misses nothing. His head is up almost constantly, his body tense, his ears tilting like radar beacons. The wranglers try to cut the two horses out of the herd. The Mustang and the corral mate he has clearly bonded with share the same natural desire, to be with the herd. The Mustang and his pal are scooting, raising little puffs of dust as they try dashes and feints and circles to rejoin the herd. Here is a reminder of the powerful herd instinct, the one that Monty must harness. I join three members of the film crew down on the flat. The director wants close-ups of the horses, so the wranglers drive them at our huddled human island. It's a thrill to be within feet of those pounding hoofs and flying manes and the hi-yahs of the wranglers. But you hope the horses remember to go around, like water round a rock, not spill over the top. Later, I see a snake on the road. We back up and catch his form heading into a gully. See the white stripes, the 4-foot black body, the diamond-shaped head, the creamy rattle. "Did you kill it?" Pat's wife Claudia wants to know back at the barn, and is disappointed we didn't. The snakes bite cattle and horses and menace ranch families from spring to fall. Monty and Caleb, meanwhile, using the corral mate as lure, draw the Mustang several miles farther up the valley to a 1,200-acre pasture where Monty in days to come will join up with this horse. Or not. Monty wears an earpiece so the director can issue instructions by radio, and it's worked passably well all day. But now, to enable dramatic overhead shots, a helicopter enters the equation. Monty stuffs a white T-shirt in his jacket. Waving it is the signal for the chopper to back off. But as he gallops to keep the Mustang in sight, the chopper misses that signal, and now it's too late. "That was the hardest part of the whole 4 days," Monty would say later. "I couldn't hear them because of the engine, and they couldn't see my signal, and they kept the horse running at 30 or 40 miles an hour. It was killing me to stay in a gallop for the better part of an hour and a half. I had to be up out of the saddle to spare the horse's back. I was unsure of the ground, and one stumble at that speed could have ended the film, and it could have killed me. I was just praying for the sun to go down." Darkness sends the chopper packing. But then comes the cold. I put on every sweater I have under my jean jacket and huddle around the campfire. Set deep into the meadow, our camp is a great circle of horse trailers and tethered horses, cars and trucks, and recreational vehicles as big as bungalows. Overhead, Comet Hale-Bopp trails its ghostly luminescence, and the stars sparkle. But there's little moon to cast light. The pasture is utterly silent, enveloped in dark like some black fog that hides even my hand in front of me. Monty's now riding Big Red Fox, a rugged-looking thoroughbred, cutting a swath through the wind and the dark. He has to stay now with the horse until they join up, however long that may take. This had been an early source of puzzlement for me. Surely the night would swallow up a wild horse, flashlight or no. "Your own horse can tell you which way the Mustang went," Monty said. "If you can listen to your own horse, He can be your compass and your guide. By 9 p.m., everyone, film crew, wranglers, kids, and dogs, has gone home or to the Buckhorn Motel in New Kiama. Claudia settles into a huge white teepee near the fire, and Pat Russell and I sit there a while discussing E. Annie Proulx's The Shipping News, a novel of Newfoundland we both admire, and one in which knots loom large. One minute this cowboy says in a slow drawl something like, "I ain't cussing him." The next minute he's talking literature. And cowboys love ropes and knots almost as much as sailors do. That day, Pat taught me the bowline for tethering horses. I borrow Pat Roberts's van and head for the Buckhorn. As I drive down the dirt road, the heater on high, I keep thinking of Monty somewhere out there. He switched horses at 6 p.m., and I heard him mutter, to the horse, maybe to himself, "You can do it, you can do it." On I drive, mystified by how the darkness has made the vast pasture bigger, the gate farther. Then the more likely prospect dawns. I'm lost. The carcass of a steer I noticed on the way in that morning, its ribs arcing and white, finally gives me back my bearings. Monty's compass is a live horse. Mine is a dead cow. Someone has closed the crude gate, but I do finally find it. Back at the Buckhorn, I'm glad of my modest bed and the long, hot shower that warms my chilled bones. While I sink into sleep, Monty and Big Red Fox and a nameless Mustang ride on. Monday, March 31st. Morning brings cold rain. The temperature is dropping fast, and the wind, after dying, is back. "It was cold, all right, and uncomfortable," Monty would say of the all-night ride. Three jackets did not keep out the cold and the damp. The Mustang took me for a long ride, maybe 100 miles. Mostly trots, but he would take off on long gallops, too. He tested every aspect of the perimeter, and I kept thinking, if Wrangler Barney Skelton had not ridden every inch of that fence line and fixed every weak point, that Mustang could have been hurt. Despite his night in the saddle, Monty looks surprisingly fresh. Says he has a second wind. During the trek, Big Red Fox grew attached to the Mustang, and though fatigued, didn't want to stop. But he's wet and shivering, and Pat Roberts rubs him down, feeds and waters him, and puts a double blanket on him. The cadet, meanwhile, still has swollen legs from yesterday's gallop. He, too, had come in Sunday at dusk, wet and trembling, his legs crying out for liniment and leg wraps. For the moment, Monty is down to one horse, Dually. The wild horse, meanwhile, is a half mile away on the other side of a high knoll and shows no sign of slowing down. All morning, Caleb and Monty try to get close to him. He begins to tolerate them to some extent, but only on the near side, the horse's left side. Approaches from the off side, the horse's right, are met with flight or anger. Now, the film crew gone for the moment, Monty and Caleb are alone with the Mustang. Only Kathy, as backup wrangler, looks on. On a high knoll overlooking the flat a quarter mile away, I lean against an old log and with my binoculars wait and see. Patiently, slowly, Monty and Caleb edge closer to the horse between them. An hour passes. Then one, now both, reach down and touch the Mustang. He doesn't at first welcome human hands on his withers and long black mane, but he learns to abide it. And what I feel on seeing that first contact is a sense of privilege. You want to mark the moment when a wild animal trusts humans enough to allow touch. In the distance, ridged mountains the color of sandpaper cast elegant black shadows and form a fittingly dramatic backdrop for boy and man and horse. The wind is bitter, but the sun is its counter. I understand why some tribes chose to leave their dead on raised wooden structures atop windswept crests like this one. In my mind is Chief Dan George's line, "It is a good day to die." This is a good place to die. Caleb touches the Mustang for longer periods now, but then Monty breaks off, as if to leave. The contract between Monty and Mustang is clear. You let me touch you. I will ride away as reward. Each time he rides a little farther, comes back a little faster. The Mustang understands. Later that afternoon, Monty, on Dooley, "I can get a quarter of an inch out of Dooley," says Monty. Neatly parks next to the Mustang and slowly slips on a halter. With the film crew up close to record all this, I too listen in. "These horses need patience," Monty tells Caleb, in that voice fathers use when passing wisdom onto a son. "If you act like you've only got 15 minutes, it'll take all day. Act like you've got all day, and it'll only take 15 minutes. The Mustang is only 30 feet from me, as I lean my elbows on a truck bed, but I cannot stop watching him through the binoculars. The detail is intoxicating. This, I know, is what so engaged Monty as a boy in Nevada, watching wild horses. I marvel at how the wind plays with the Mustang's long forelocks, how lively his large eyes are, how the fetlocks are so rich in feathery white hair, how explosive he can be when he feels his space invaded. I have yet to hear him make a sound, though he has plenty to say. "Do you want to ride my horse?" Kathy asks me during a lull. She has seen me walking the cadet beyond the camp and helping with grooming, so of course I'm delighted to ride. Down the fence line, about a quarter mile, it happens. I hear the rattle first, far louder and more menacing than even the movies make it sound, then see the pale, angry snake slither off. The horse has come within a foot of stepping on it. He has no doubt seen snakes before. There's no scream of alarm, no pawing of the air, just my beating eastern heart. When I report this second sighting to the wranglers lying in a circle on their elbows, the first question from Barney is, "Did you kill it?" If, Scott tells me, I see a third snake and similarly fail to dispatch it, I owe them 24 beers. Cowboy math. Monty, meanwhile, is asking the Mustang about putting on a surcingle, a wide girth used to accustom him to the tight cinch and a precursor to a saddle. First, he delicately lays the belt across the Mustang's back, but the sound of its metal buckles spooks him, and Monty stops to tape them. Cinching the surcingle with Monty and Caleb in the saddle requires the use of a 4-foot metal hook. It looks like a tool to pluck keys from inside a locked car. Monty slowly lowers the hook blindly below the horse's belly, and with Caleb directing from the other side of the horse, catches the dangling belt, draws it up delicately, and finally cinches the surcingle. Depending on who Monty's riding, the Mustang is either submissively snapping, stretching out his neck with his mouth open like a foal, or flattening his ears and striking out with his hooves. A borrowed horse called George gets the rude treatment. Big Dooley gets the sweetness and light. When Monty rides into camp that evening around supper time, after 35 hours in the saddle, stopping only to relieve himself and switch horses, his stance is a little wider than I remember, but so is his smile. In the bar that night at the Buckhorn, while far too many oversized and stuffed stags look on, we all celebrate. The end, it seems, is in sight. The Mustang will get a good night's sleep in an enclosure at camp, but then again, so will Monty in the Buckhorn. April 1st, 1997. While I, with regret, head home, Monty continues schooling the horse he will call Shy Boy. The weather has become more California-like, sunny and warm. The wind has stopped howling. Driving west to Santa Maria and the airport, I have the voices of the English film director, John Groom, and that of the head wrangler, Pat Russell, in my head from days of listening to the crackle of the walkie-talkie. "Monty," John would begin. "Say again." "Morny," Pat would say. "You want that other horse of yours?" April 2nd, 1997. This is day four, and by now Monty has learned a few things about Shy Boy. "He's intelligent," says Monty, "and tolerant to a degree. He does not, however, like to be outside his language." In the morning, Monty decides the time has come for the Mustang to be ridden. And while the horse now tolerates being touched, haltered, and even saddled, what the film audience may see is how dangerous he remains. Scott Silvera, who'd been chosen as the first person to ride the Mustang, is extremely capable in the saddle and even rides Bronx at the rodeo, but he cannot speak the language of the horse as Monty can. That puts him, as Monty says, outside the Mustang's language. When Scott gets close for the first time, the horse jumps back, then lands a blow with one front foot. Later in the day, as Monty releases Shy Boy, he moves too quickly to untie a knot, and the horse strikes him hard on the hand. "It was my fault," says Monty. And the horse came right back up, licking and chewing. It was reactive on his part. Finally, Scott does get on. The Mustang was reluctant during the mounting, but once Scott was on, calmly accepted the rider. "When Scott's bottom touched the saddle," says Monty, "that was a very emotional moment for me." 2 days afterward, Monty called me. "It's just sinking in," he said. "The desire to do what I did must have been buried deep, because right now I'm exploding." He had the proof he wanted, for all to see. Shy Boy now resides at Flag Is Up Farms, where Monty joined up with him once more on Thursday of that week, but this time in a 50-foot round pen. A far cry from days before, when a man 6 weeks short of 62 made fast and epic circles in a vast and epic pasture and politely asked a wild horse for a word or two. This book has been very much about looking back on an extraordinary life with horses. But Monty Roberts, never one to aim low in terms of ambition, has set his sights on what might be called a world learning center. Based at his farm near Solvang, California, it would ensure that his methods would go on being taught to new generations of gentlers. His son Marty, whose law practice specializes in equine matters, may well administer the center if it comes to pass. Meanwhile, Monty's been lobbying certain people who are impressed with his work and who might be willing to bankroll a trust fund and launch the school. "Ambitions change as you go," says Monty. "At one time, I might have said that my goal was to win 3 Kentucky Derbies in a row. Now I feel a higher calling. I've got to hurry. If I've got 10 years left, I'll be fortunate. But if I die tomorrow, I don't die. Enough of what I've taught will go on for the next few generations at least." Monty's dreams are lofty, but he's in the habit of realizing them. The vision now is for Flag Is Up Farms, already a world-class thoroughbred racehorse facility, to become a mecca for horse gentlers. Trainers from every land, or at least every land where horses matter, would learn to work harmoniously with horses and take back with them a body of knowledge to pass on to others. With luck and diligence, Monty Roberts's way would become the way of the future. The whips and spurs and crops and bits as fierce as weapons would all be tossed, maybe this time for good. A few might reside in the glass cases of museums, where people of a more enlightened future may examine them and shake their heads in wonder and dismay. Whatever possessed our ancestors, those people may ask, to use such barbaric instruments on an animal so noble, so sweetly disposed, as the horse? Lawrence Scanlon. If you've enjoyed this book, Recorded Books recommends The Horse Whisperer by Nicholas Evans, narrated by Frank Muller. You'll find a wide selection of titles, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more, in the Recorded Books catalog. So to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, call us toll-free nationwide at 1-800-638-1304. You can order by phone with Visa or MasterCard, or by writing to us, or by faxing us at 410-535-5499. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.